It reduces one's capacity. It excels in control. Conscience deeply reveres people and sees their potential for self-control. Conscience empowers. It reflects the worth and value of all people and affirms their power and freedom to choose. Then natural self-control emerges, imposed neither from above nor from the outside. Conscience is inclusive. Ego is exclusive. Ego is threatened by negative feedback and punishes the messenger. It interprets all data in terms of self-preservation. It constantly censors information. It denies much of reality. Conscience values feedback and attempts to discern whatever truth it contains. It isn't afraid of information and can accurately interpret what's going on. It has no need to censor information and is open to an awareness of reality from every direction. Ego is myopic and interprets all of life through its own agenda. Conscience is a social ecologist, listening to and sensing the entire system and environment. It fills the body with light, is able to democratize ego, and reflect more accurately the entire world. Conscience is sacrifice, the subordinating of one's self or one's ego to a higher purpose, cause, or principle. Again, sacrifice really means giving up something good for something better. But in the mind of the purpose sacrificing, there really is no sacrifice. Only to the observer is it sacrifice. Sacrifice can take many forms as it manifests itself in the four dimensions of our lives, making physical and economic sacrifices that would represent the body, cultivating an open, inquisitive mind and purging oneself of prejudices. That's the mind. Showing deep respect and love to others. The heart. And subordinating one's own will to a higher will for the greater good. The spirit. Conscience teaches us that ends and means are inseparable, that ends actually pre-exist in the means. Immanuel Kant taught that the means used to accomplish the ends are as important as those ends. Machiavelli taught the opposite, that the ends justify the means. Consider the seven things that, according to Gandhi's teaching, will destroy us. If you study them slowly and carefully, you will see in a powerful way how each represents an end being accomplished through an unprincipled or unworthy means. First, wealth without work. Second, pleasure without conscience. Third, knowledge without character. Fourth, commerce without morality. Fifth, science without humanity. Sixth, worship without sacrifice. Seven, politics without principle. Isn't it interesting how each of these admirable ends can be falsely attained? But if you reach an admirable end through the wrong means, the ends ultimately turn to dust in your hands. In your business dealings, you know that those who are honest with you and who keep their promises and commitments, you trust. You also know exactly those who are duplicitous, deceitful, and dishonest. Even when you reach a legal contract agreement with those who are dishonest, do you really trust they'll come through and keep their word? I love the teaching of Mother Teresa. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true friends. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you. Be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone could destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world your best anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. It's conscience that constantly tells us the value of both ends and means, and how they are really inseparable. Close quote. It's conscience that constantly tells us the value of both ends and means, and how they are really inseparable. But it's ego that tells us that the end justifies the means, unaware that a worthy end can never be really accomplished in a sustainable way with an unworthy means. It may appear that you can, but there are unintended consequences that are not seen or evident at first that will eventually destroy the end. For instance, you can yell at your kids to clean their rooms, and if your end is to have a clean room, you'll accomplish just that. But I'll guarantee you that not only will the means negatively affect the relationships, but the room won't stay clean when you leave town for a few days. Conscience profoundly alters vision, discipline, and passion by introducing us into the world of relationships. It moves us from an independent to an interdependent state, because that is the way the world is. And when this happens, everything is altered. You realize that vision and values must be shared before people will be willing to accept the institutionalized discipline of structures and systems that embody those shared values. Such shared vision creates discipline and order without demanding them. Conscience often provides the why. Vision identifies what you are trying to accomplish. Discipline represents how you're going to accomplish it, and passion represents the strength of feelings behind the why, the what, and the how. As we move from independence into interdependence, conscience transforms passion into compassion. It engenders sincere caring for others, a combination of both sympathy and empathy, where one's pain is shared and received. Compassion is the interdependent expression of passion. Guidepost contributor Joanne C. Jones related an experience in which a university professor taught her to live and learn by the guidance of her conscience. Here are her words. During my second month of nursing school, our professor gave us a pop quiz. I was a conscientious student and had breezed through the questions until I read the last one. What is the first name of the person who cleans the school? Surely this was some kind of joke. I had seen the cleaning woman several times. She was tall, dark-haired, and in her 50s. But how would I know her name? I handed in my paper, leaving the last question blank. Before the class ended, one student asked if the last question would count toward our quiz grade. Absolutely, said the professor. In your careers, you will meet many people. All are significant. They deserve your attention and care, even if all you do is smile and say hello. I've never forgotten that lesson. I also learned her name was Dorothy. Close quote. When people strive to live by their conscience, it produces integrity and peace of mind. German-born Presbyterian minister and motivational speaker and author William J. Boechter said earlier in the 20th century, that you may retain your self-respect, it is better to displease the people by doing what you know is right than to temporarily please them by doing what you know is wrong. Close quote. This self-respect and integrity, in turn, produce in those who possess them the ability to be both kind and courageous with other people. Kind in that they show great respect and reverence for other people, their views, feelings, experiences, and convictions, but also courageous in that they express their own convictions without personal threat. The interplay between differing opinions can produce those third alternatives that are better than what either person had initially proposed. This is true synergy, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. People who do not live by their conscience will not experience this internal integrity and peace of mind. They will find their ego attempting to control relationships, even though they might pretend or feign kindness and empathy from time to time. They will use subtle forms of manipulation and will even go so far as to engage in kind but dictatorial behavior. The private victory of integrity is the foundation for the public victories of establishing a common vision, discipline, and passion. Leadership becomes an interdependent work rather than an immature interplay between strong, independent, ego-driven rulers and compliant, dependent followers. Now let's look at a beautiful film, Stone. There is a man in Uganda who beautifully illustrates the power of allowing conscience to wisely direct his vision, discipline, and passion. His name is Stone, and he was a great soccer player. In fact, the dream of every kid in Uganda is to become good enough at soccer that the European clubs will sign him or her as a player. The big serious money from Europe was looking at Stone, who was playing professionally in Uganda, when during a game someone purposely hit him in a way that blew out his knee. His professional career was over. Stone could have become vindictive or revengeful. He could have wallowed in self-pity or lived in his celebrity for the rest of his life. But he didn't. Instead, he chose his response. He used his imagination, that is his vision, and his conscience to inspire and influence young problem Ugandan boys and teenagers who would otherwise be lost in life with no marketable skills, no role models, and no hope. I would like to invite you to see Stone in action. I want you to feel his spirit and to sense his heart and vision. You can see Stone's story in a short, powerful, award-winning film that's included on the DVD attached at the back of this book. I know you will enjoy this experience. As you watch the film, notice how Stone overcame his cultural overlay toward revenge by tapping into his birth gifts. Notice how he personally paid the price in sacrifice and discipline. Notice also how, with unrelenting passion, he reached out to the young men in his country so that they too could learn to govern their own lives by their conscience, as well as gain a vision of becoming first a good soccer player, then economically self-reliant, and then responsible adults, fathers, and contributing citizens. Notice how they gradually became more and more independent of Stone, so that they themselves were governed by the principles, that is, conscience, of self-mastery, training, and contribution. Notice finally how Stone communicated the worth and potential of these young men so clearly they were inspired to see it in themselves. You might be interested to know that a longtime colleague of mine visited Stone in Uganda several years after this film was made. He offered this update on Stone. "I was so impressed with the balance of his body, mind, heart, and spirit. He is very physically active, relentlessly teaching his boys soccer, 6 different teams a day. His mind is alert, always looking for new ways to achieve his mission of guiding the youth to new horizons. He is a Christian but lives in a Muslim neighborhood with a Muslim landlord. His daily actions engender peace and harmony in his neighborhood. Socially, he cares for each child, parent, and person he meets. His character and deep integrity move me well beyond even what is portrayed in this film." Here is a brief summary and a final challenge to part one, Find Your Voice, which is the first half of Habit 8. As we approach the end of this section on finding your voice, let's go back and reconnect with our main purposes. We know that there is a painful gap between possessing great potential and actually realizing a life of greatness and contribution. Between being aware of tremendous problems and challenges in the workplace and developing the internal power and moral authority to break out of those problems and become a significant creative force in solving them. I commend to you again this simple way of thinking about life, this simple paradigm. A whole person, body, mind, heart, and spirit, with 4 basic needs: to live, to learn, to love, to leave a legacy, and four intelligences or capacities, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, and their highest manifestations, discipline, vision, passion, and conscience, all of which represent the four dimensions of voice: need, talent, passion, and conscience. So you'll notice the basic underlying paradigm simply adds one word as we explore the different dimensions we have been discussing. As we respect, develop, integrate, and balance these intelligences in their highest manifestations, the synergy between them lights the fire within us, and we find our voice. You may be interested to know that I first introduced the idea and language of the fire within in the book First Things First, co-authored with Roger and Rebecca Merrill. Years later, the Salt Lake Organizing Committee for the 2002 Winter Olympics called me requesting permission to use as a central theme of the 2002 Games, Light the Fire Within. Without hesitation, I said, of course, we would be honored. I was inspired and thrilled to see how they used the Light the Fire Within theme to portray the magnificent potential of the human spirit. Several weeks after the Games, the Salt Lake Olympic Committee President, Mitt Romney, told me that it's the first time he knows of in the history of the Olympic Games that the organizers were successfully able to create a lasting, identifying theme that actually took hold in the hearts and minds of the athletes, volunteers, and worldwide viewers. In Chapter 1, I suggested that voice lies at the nexus of talent, your natural gifts and strengths, passion, those things that naturally energize, excite, motivate, and inspire you, need, including what the world needs enough to pay you for, and conscience, that still small voice within that assures you of what is right and that prompts you to actually do it. I also said that when you engage in work, professional, community, and family that taps your talent and fuels your passion, that rises out of a great need in the world that you feel drawn by conscience to meet, therein lies your voice, your calling, your soul's code, your personal DNA. Perhaps you have noticed the similarity between these four dimensions of voice and the four personal leadership attributes of vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. Two of the terms, passion and conscience, are identical. These four dimensions of voice, that is, passion, talent, need, and conscience, are beautifully illustrated in the story of Muhammad Yunus. How did he find his voice? First, he sensed the need. The voice of conscience inspired him to take action. Since his talent matched the need, he disciplined his talent to provide a solution. The work involved in the solution not only drew upon his talent, but it also tapped his passion. Out of need grew vision, vision to multiply the capacity of people and institutions to meet similar needs around the world, and thereby inspire them to find their voice. With the end to Part 1, Find Your Voice, I extend to you a promise and a challenge. My promise is this: if you will apply these four capacities, talent, passion, need, and conscience, to any role of your life, you can find your voice in that role. My simple challenge: take two or three of the primary roles in your life, and in each role, ask yourself the following four questions. First, what need do I sense in your family, your community, your organization you work for? Second, do I possess a true talent that, if disciplined and applied, can meet the need? Third, does the opportunity to meet the need tap into my passion? And fourth, does my conscience inspire me to take action and become involved? If you can answer all four questions in the affirmative and will make a habit of developing a plan of action and then going to work on it, I guarantee you will begin to find your true voice in life, a life of deep meaning, satisfaction, and greatness. In a very real sense, you will be creating your voice. Now let's look at some questions and answers. And these questions deal with some very, very practical issues that people are facing on a regular basis. And you can see how this paradigm, this thinking, can apply. Here's a question. Could this approach to personal leadership help me solve one of my lifelong challenges, losing weight and staying in shape? My answer is, if you're like most people, you've resolved from time to time to get into shape, and in most cases, this usually involved losing some weight. Oftentimes, getting into shape merely means replacing fat with muscle, which may actually increase your weight since muscle weighs about twice as much as fat. Nevertheless, our fundamental task is to get into shape and become physically healthy, strong, and fit. That is the vision. What is the discipline? Usually it involves a strict regimen of exercise, proper nutrition, rest, and stress management. Passion represents the depth of feeling, the emotional commitment, and the drive. Conscience provides the why, the reason, the worthy causes of being healthy so that you can live longer, provide for your family properly, help raise your grandchildren, or simply feel better. You'll also find that if the motivation is only external, that is, looking better, vanity, a change of season, New Year's resolution time, etc., etc., such motivation will often lose its power and fail to sustain itself because the cause is not worthy of such a total commitment. Before making a bad food choice, train yourself to inwardly say, "My temptation is emotional, and resisting will further my needed weight loss and strengthen my character. Furthermore, nothing tastes as good as thin feels." It is very common to become discouraged by the cycle of setting a goal to lose weight and then abandoning it within days or even hours. Many complained, "I'm just not disciplined." My experience is that the biggest problem is not the discipline. It's not that we have not yet paid the price with vision. We're also not yet connected with our deepest values and motivations, our conscience, with those things most important to us. Let me illustrate with the experience of a friend of mine. He said this, "I had been working very hard on my career. By the time I turned 45, I was quite successful. I was also about 60 pounds overweight, a compulsive eater during times of stress, and one who didn't have time to exercise regularly because of work. On his 5th birthday, my son Logan gave me a book on healthy living. Inside, his mother had helped him write the following words, 'Daddy, for my birthday this year, I want you to be healthy. I want you to be around a while.' Talk about a punch in the gut. Ouch. That plea from my son changed my perspective on my lifestyle completely. The eating and the lack of regular physical exercise weren't just my individual choice anymore. I saw suddenly that I was creating a very unhealthy legacy for my children. I was modeling for them that one's body was unimportant, that self-control was unimportant, and that the only thing worth working hard for in this life was money and prestige. I realized that my stewardship to my children involved more than just providing for their physical, financial, and emotional needs. It also involved providing healthy role models on which they could pattern their lives. I had not been doing that. So I committed myself to being healthy for my children, not to losing weight, but to being healthy. That's the key for me. My commitment had to be to something that held real value for me. I had tried so many diets and exercise programs before. Normally, I would be fine until stresses happened in my life. To have losing weight as my inspiring motivation was simply not enough. But my children are significant enough. I care enough about them that I can choose to make healthy decisions. I established as a goal for myself that I wanted to be healthy. I wanted to be vital, to have energy to play with my kids after work, to be able to play in the company softball tournament without getting winded on the way to first base. As a way to reach that goal, I implemented a diet and exercise program. The key here is that the diet and exercise program was not the goal. Being healthy for my children was. I decided to share my goal with somebody else who wanted to be healthy. We now work together on an exercise program. I made sure I set aside time for me to accomplish my goals. I learned to know when to stop working and when to pay attention to the needs of my body. It has been 2 years since I changed my way of thinking. I don't struggle anymore to get out of bed. Exercise has almost become second nature. I don't talk myself out of my exercise program like I did at the beginning. Sure, there are still days that I don't do too well. I think I'm tired, I think my hamstring is strained, I have a headache, it's too hot. Some days I plain talk myself out of running. But it's so much easier now for me to get back on track, because I have this larger goal, this greater commitment to somebody I love more than myself. I can get right back on track.
Another question that many people are asking, what about getting a job? My answer is, getting into shape is primarily an independent effort. Getting the job you want is primarily a highly interdependent effort, and it relies on effective development of influence with other people. Now let's think through how to get the job you want by looking at the same four attributes of personal influence: vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. Again, the key is all four. Neglect any one of them, and you'll find it much more difficult to get the job you want. And if you do get it, you will likely not be able to sustain what you committed to and what it requires of you. Now let's just assume that there's a very soft job market and that most employers are letting people go, not hiring, particularly in the industry and the city where you want to live and work. How do you get the job that you want? First of all, let's start with vision. You need to know what the job is that you want. Use discipline to figure out what the job actually entails. Use discipline to understand the job, to understand the organization you want to be employed by, to understand the unique requirements of the job, and to understand the marketplace so that you understand the forces that are in place, including competition, customers' wants and needs, and the characteristics and trends in that industry. In other words, pay the price to understand the challenges and problems faced by the organization you want to join. Next, identify where your passion is. That is, does this job uniquely reflect your talent, gifts, interests, capabilities, and skills? If so, does your conscience tell you that this is a job worthy of being committed to? If so, can you envision yourself working in this manner? Now, after you've done all this preliminary work using vision, discipline, passion, and conscience, you are ready to go to the job interview. But this time, you don't go as a problem for the interviewer to deal with, but as a solution to the problems that decision makers are facing. You see the difference? You are a problem solver because you understand the nature of those problems. When you show an understanding of their most significant problems better than most of the people in their present employ, when you show a passion and commitment to meet their situation better than most of the people, you give yourself a tremendous advantage. Suggest, if necessary, even a trial period, even at your own expense, until they become convinced that you are a better solution to their problem than anyone else that they're looking at, or than many that they may already have in their employ. Simply because you are a leader, you take initiative to make good things happen. You don't wait to be told. You're not always being acted upon. You act, but you're not foolish in your action. You are very aware. You are very sensitive. You are very empathic and respectful. You also engage in this job-finding process in a principled way. There is no exaggeration for effect, no deceit, no manipulation, no lying, no cheating, no duplicity, or putting other people down. You become very focused on the organization's needs, their concerns, their problems, and on their customers' needs, concerns, and problems. You talk that language, the language of their problems and the language of their customers' problems. If you're a father, the way I reach your heart is to talk about your children. Similarly in business, you talk about your customers' customers. Anyone that will take such an approach with the decision maker will get attention. In fact, in most cases, it will blow them away with the depth of your preparation and discipline and your willingness to pay the price and sacrifice. You know, I've given this counsel over and over and over again to so many people through the years, and only a small percentage would take it. But in almost every case, they succeeded in getting the job they wanted, to live where they wanted to live. I also usually recommend that they study the latest edition of the book, What Color Is Your Parachute? By Richard Bowles, to help them better understand this process. But it is a clear illustration of how vision, discipline, passion, and conscience applies in securing the job you want. Another very common question that all of us face and that I'm asked all the time, how does all this help me in achieving life balance? My answer is this. Survey after survey indicates that one of the greatest challenges faced by most people is this question of life balance. People tend to focus so much, often on work or other pressing activities, that the relationships and activities they really treasure the most end up getting squeezed and pushed aside. They end up becoming addicted to urgency, particularly work urgency, and neglect their family, their health, and even their integrity. Let me illustrate a solution with the story of a man who got caught up in this whirlpool of urgency. Now notice, as you listen to this story, that he took time to think about what mattered most to him. That deals with conscience, with vision and passion. And then he used those criteria to creatively decide how to organize his life to be in harmony with his principles and to create the life balance he desired. That deals with the discipline dimension. Notice also how the solution came through synergy with his wife. Here is his true story told in his own words. I have always had a special friendship with my mother. Together we endured a series of life events which has created a wonderful relationship. At one time in my life, even though I loved my mother and really enjoyed spending time with her, I got caught up in my commitments to work, the community, and to my own family. My life got so busy, weeks would go by before I could even make a quick phone call just to check in. And when I did manage to squeeze in a visit, we would just have sat down to talk, and it would be my time for me to leave. Another meeting to go to, another deadline to meet. My contact with this wonderful woman, my mother, literally became hit and miss. My mother never put any pressure on me to visit more often, but I wasn't happy with the situation. I knew my life was out of control if I couldn't consistently spend quality time with my own mother. So my wife and I brainstormed for a solution. She suggested scheduling a time each week or so that would work for both our family and my mother. When we looked at the calendar, we saw my wife has choir practice every Wednesday evening. That night became my night to spend with my mom. Now my mom knows that every week or two, I will be coming on a specific night at a specific time. I won't be running off within the first 10 minutes, and then there are a few interruptions. If she wants to get some exercise, we go for a walk together. Other times she'll cook a meal for me. Sometimes I'll take her shopping at the mall, which is further away than she feels comfortable driving to alone. No matter what we do, we always talk. About family, about current events, about memories. Every evening I spend with my mother is a peaceful oasis in my busy life. I tell my wife it's one of the best suggestions she has ever given me. Close quote. This beautiful little story is just one illustration of what can be done when we focus our hearts and minds upon what truly matters, and then live with integrity to do it. When my own father died, I decided I was going to maintain and even increase my very special relationship with my mother because of the new void in her life. I resolved that despite a very heavy travel schedule, and no matter where I was, I would phone her every day for the rest of her life. Though we live 50 miles apart, I would also make special efforts to visit her at least every 2 weeks. She lived for another 10 years, and I cannot begin to express the depth of my gratitude for her life and for the preciousness of our time together. I learned that when you regularly communicate with another person, you reach a new level of understanding that almost runs by nuance. I found that the daily phone call was not too unlike our semi-weekly visit. We felt as close to each other and as open and authentic with each other as we did when we were together. It was like one continuous conversation. It really didn't make much difference whether it was on the phone or face-to-face, which surprised me, because I always thought nothing could replace face-to-face contact. I am sure in another sense that is correct, but each conversation contains the cumulative effect of the previous conversations, so there is hardly anything to catch up on. Instead, you can share deep insights and feelings rather than just experiences. You can move ahead. Intimate communication means into me see. Just like the gentleman in the previous story, I too have had the tremendous benefit of having a very supportive and understanding wife who has an abundance mentality. My wife Sandra doesn't see life as a fixed piece of pie where there's only so much time, where time with my mother would mean time away from her. She saw that time with my mother would actually increase the depth of our own relationship. In fact, when Mother passed away, we put on her tombstone a line from Shakespeare's 29th sonnet, "For thy sweet love remembered, such wealth brings." I would encourage you to read this sonnet slowly and carefully. In fact, let me read it to you right now. Let your imagination fill in the richness and meaning of each phrase, and think about it in terms of your life, and whose sweet love remembered such wealth brings. Here is the sonnet. When in disgrace, with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy, contented least, yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising, from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. Perhaps the highest way to bring balance to life is the family. The first and most demanding form of personal growth also takes place in the family, and it also provides the greatest contribution to society, for no society has ever survived its breakup. And no one on their deathbed ever wished they'd spent more time at work or watching television. I believe, as one wise leader said, that the most important work that we will ever do will be within the walls of our own home. Another great leader, David O. McKay, taught, "No other success can compensate for failure in the home." My convictions about the importance of family are so deep and strong that they led me several years ago to write the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families. Parenthood is the most important leadership responsibility in life and will provide the greatest levels of happiness and joy. And when true leadership, that is, vision, discipline, passion, and conscience, body, mind, heart, and spirit, is not manifested in parenthood, it will provide the greatest source of sorrow and disappointment. It's amazing to me how small adjustments in one's life along the lines of vision, discipline, passion, and conscience can have such huge consequences. I believe all of us at a future date will be both amazed and saddened by the realization of how such small changes could have brought about such big results. For parents to instill a sense of vision and possibility into a family, to exercise the discipline and sacrifice to pull that vision off, and to endure through the difficult times with a deep sense of passion, drive, and commitment, all in a conscience-driven way, I suggest is the ultimate and best test of leadership. If part of the vision is to see this family culture transmitted from generation to generation, perhaps in that alone will our lives be fulfilled and joyful, even if we accomplish nothing else. But if we fail in that, we may find that success in other things will not adequately compensate. I often think about the poignant words of John Greenleaf Whittier. For all sad words of tongue and pen, the saddest are these: it might have been. But someone else taught, it is never too late for us to become what we might have been. And now we move to part two of the book, Inspire Others to Find Their Voice. See, the eighth habit has two parts in it: Find Your Voice, and part two now, Inspire Others to Find Their Voice. This takes us into chapter 6. The title is Inspiring Others to Find Their Voice. That is the leadership challenge. Albert Schweitzer said, in everyone's life at some time, our inner fire goes out. It is then burst into flame by an encounter with another human being. We should all be thankful for those people who rekindle the inner spirit. Close quote. When I was a young man, I had an experience with a leader that profoundly shaped the rest of my life. I had decided to take a break in my education to give some extended volunteer service. The invitation came to go to England. Just 4 1/2 months after my arrival, the president of the organization came to me and said, I have a new assignment for you. I want you to travel around the country and train local leaders. I was shocked. Who was I to train leaders 2 and 3 times my age? Sensing my doubt, he simply looked me in the eye and said, I have great confidence in you. You can do this. I will give you materials to help you prepare to teach these leaders and to facilitate their sharing best practices with one another. His confidence, his ability to see more in me than I saw in myself, his willingness to entrust me with responsibility that would stretch me to my potential, literally unlocked something within me. I accepted the assignment and gave my best. It tapped me physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I grew. I saw others grow. I saw patterns and basic leadership principles. By the time I returned home after 2 years, I had begun to detect the work I wanted to devote my life to, unleashing human potential. I found my voice, and it was my leader that inspired me to find it. I realized in time that I wasn't the only one he treated this way. His affirmation of others, his ability to unite us in vision toward our work that inspired and motivated us, his pattern of providing us with enabling resources and empowering us as true leaders with accountability and stewardship became the norm in our entire organization. We began to lead and serve others in the same way, and the results were remarkable. I've realized since then that the principles that guided his leadership are common to great leadership in any organization, regardless of the level or formal position of the person. My teaching, consulting, and leadership experience in business, university, volunteer, and church organizations, and especially in my own family, have taught me that leadership influence is governed by principles. When you live by them, your influence and moral authority increase, and you are often given even greater formal authority. The biblical parables of the pounds and of the talents illustrate that the more you use and magnify the gifts or talents you have been given, the more gifts and talents you are given. But if they are ignored or buried and remain undeveloped and unused, the very talents or gifts that you have been given will be lost and often given to another. So you end up not only losing talents, but also losing influence and opportunities. New heading: Leadership Defined. Simply put, at its most elemental and practical level, I suggest that leadership is communicating to people their worth and potential so clearly that they come to see it in themselves. Think about this definition. Let me restate it. Leadership is communicating people's worth and potential so clearly that they come to see it in themselves. Isn't this the essence of the kind of leadership that influences and truly endures? I frequently ask large audiences, how many of you have achieved your level of success, partly or even largely, because some person communicated to you your worth and your potential, that they believed in you when you didn't believe in yourself? And you know what I find? About half the people raise their hands. And if I take the time to interview them, to visit with them, they usually come to tears, and often it brings others to tears. You see, to communicate the worth and potential of others so clearly, so powerfully, so consistently, that they really come to see it in themselves, is to set into motion the process of seeing, doing, and becoming. Think about it. What a way this is to think about your irreplaceable role of parenting and of grandparenting. In fact, the most essential role of grandparents is this: to communicate in as many ways as possible the worth and potential of their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren so clearly that they really believe it and act upon that belief. If this spirit suffused our culture and our society, the impact on the civilization of the world would be unimaginably magnificent and endless. It would go on from generation to generation. Let's explore in depth, perhaps next to relationships, the most common and continuous means of communicating to people their worth and potential. You know where that lies? In the organization. It stands next to relationships, because that's where people spend most of their life. So as we move to part two of the eighth habit, inspire others to find their voice, we enter into the domain of leadership. Again, this is not leadership as a formal position, but leadership as a choice to deal with people in a way that will communicate to them their worth and potential so clearly they will come to see it in themselves. Regarding our focus on this kind of leadership in the organization, I would like to emphasize four simple points. First, at the most elemental level, an organization is nothing more or less than a relationship with a purpose. That purpose you could call its voice. That purpose is aimed at meeting the needs of one or more persons or stakeholders. The simplest organization would be two people who share a purpose, such as in a simple business partnership or in a marriage. Second, almost all people belong to an organization of one kind or another. Third, most of the world's work is done in and through organizations. Four, the highest challenge inside organizations, including families, is to set them up and run them in a way that enables each person to inwardly sense his or her innate worth and potential for greatness, and to contribute his or her unique talents and passion, in other words, voice, to accomplish the organization's purpose and highest priorities in a principle-centered way. We could call this the leadership challenge. In short, an organization is made up of individuals who have a relationship and a shared purpose. You can see then how this organizational application applies to each and every one of us. New heading: Management and or Leadership. Literally hundreds of books and thousands of articles have come out in the last few years on leadership. This points how vital the subject is. You see, leadership really is the enabling art. The purpose of schools is educating kids, but if you have bad leadership, you have bad education. The purpose of medicine is helping people get well, but if you have bad leadership, you have bad medicine. We could give illustration after illustration to show that leadership is the highest of the arts, simply because it enables all the other arts and professions to work. This is particularly true for a family. I've spent a lifetime studying, teaching, and writing on both leadership and management. In fact, as part of my preparation for writing this book, I initiated a literature review of leadership theories of the 20th century. As part of the literature review of leadership theories, we gathered statements from leading authors who described the differences between leadership and management. Here's just a small sampling. Warren Bennis said, "Leaders are people who do the right thing. Managers are people who do things right." John Cotter said, "Leadership is about coping with change. Management is about coping with complexity." Kuzis and Pochner said, "Leadership has about it a kinesthetic feel, a sense of movement. Managing is about handling things, about maintaining order, about organization and control." Abraham Selesnik said, "Leaders are concerned with what things mean to people. Managers are concerned about how things get done." John Mariotti said, "Leaders are the architects. Managers are the builders." George Weathersby said, "Leadership focuses on the creation of a common vision. Management is the design of work. It's about controlling." That is just a sample, but this leadership review has reinforced to me that both management and leadership are vital, and that either one without the other is insufficient. At times in my own life, I've fallen into the trap of overemphasizing leadership and neglecting the importance of management. I'm sure this is because it's become so evident to me that most organizations, families included, are vastly overmanaged and desperately underled. This gap has been a major motivating force in my professional work and has led me to focus on the principles of leadership. Nevertheless, I've been powerfully reminded again and again of the vital part that management plays. I've learned, painfully, that you can't lead things. In fact, it wasn't until I turned over the management of my own company to my son Stephen and a team of people with strengths that compensated for my weaknesses that it really became profitable. You can't lead inventories and cash flow and costs. You have to manage them. Why? Because things don't have the power and freedom to choose. Only people do. So you lead, that is, empower people. You manage and control things. For instance, here's a list of the kinds of things you need to manage, to control. Things without freedom to choose: money, costs, information, time, structures, systems, processes, inventory, physical resources, facilities, tools, etc. In fact, sometimes people choose to be managed under their own leadership. Many professionals and other producers are in this situation. I myself am. Leadership gives the vision and the criteria, the larger context. Then management provides the day-to-day direction and control. But this becomes the choice of the person. By the way, this literature review has also reminded me how profoundly I've been influenced by many of these great minds and teachers over the years. To them, I owe a deep debt of gratitude. My experiences and teaching has also led me to conclude that the key to understanding organizational behavior is not to study organizational behavior per se. It is to study and understand human nature. For once you understand the fundamental elements of human nature, you possess the key to unlock the potential inside of people and organizations. This is exactly why the whole person paradigm, symbolized by body, mind, heart, and spirit, is supremely relevant to understanding organizations as well as individuals. In a very real sense, there is no such thing as organizational behavior. There is only individual behavior collectivized in organizations. So what, you may ask? Why does all this theory have to do with the challenges I face day in and day out? Why is it so necessary to understand organizations to better understand and solve my problems? The simple, almost obvious answer is that they are so interrelated. We all live in and work in one organization or another, including that of the family. We need context to understand ourselves. We need the bigger picture, the larger context. As mentioned earlier, all organizations, even the best of them, are absolutely filled with problems. I've worked with thousands. Even the organizations I admire most struggle to some degree. And the interesting thing is that most of the problems are about the same. Certainly, there are unique personalities and circumstances connected to the problems, but when it comes right down to it, at the core, most problems have common roots. Peter Drucker put it this way, quote, "There are, of course, differences in management between different organizations. Missions define strategy, after all, and strategy defines structure. But the differences between managing a chain of retail stores and managing a Roman Catholic diocese are amazingly fewer than retail executives or bishops realize. The differences are mainly in the application rather than principles. The executives of all of these organizations spend, for instance, about the same amount of time on people problems, and the people problems are almost always the same. Whether you're managing a software company, a hospital, a bank, or a Boy Scout organization, the differences apply to only about 10% of your work. This 10% is determined by the organization's specific mission, its specific culture, its specific history, and its specific vocabulary. The rest is pretty much interchangeable." Close quote. My goal in part two, that is to inspire others to find their voice, is to help you discover how, by working and struggling to solve your personal challenges and problems, you can greatly increase your own influence and the influence of your organization, whether it be your team, department, division, or the entire organization, including your family. Let's begin by looking first at the dual nature of the problems we face. Before we do, I invite you to gear up your mind for the energy it will take to really get your arms around our complex organizational challenges. I do so with two quotes. The first is again the observation by Albert Einstein. Quote, "The significant challenges we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." Close quote. You have been given a new paradigm of human nature. The whole person paradigm, body, mind, heart, and spirit. You have learned that it stands in great contrast to today's industrial age thing paradigm of control. You will need this whole person view to understand and solve the problems you face in your organization. The second quote is by Oliver Wendell Holmes. He said, I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on the near side of complexity. But I would give my right arm for the simplicity on the far side of complexity. Close quote. What this means is that our significant challenges cannot be solved with simplistic, little quick-fix programs of the month or psych-up slogans and formulas. We must earn a comprehension of the nature and root of the problems we face in organizations, and likewise earn our learnings about the principles that govern the solutions by incorporating the new mindset and skill set they represent into our very character. This will require some real effort, but I promise you, if you will hang in there, you will be empowered with a powerfully simple and clear combination of knowledge, attitude, and skill, the three elements of habit that will make you equal to the new challenges of the new world. You will have developed the eighth habit that unleashes human potential. New heading, Global Seismic Shifts. As we move now to seek a deeper understanding of the organizational challenge, I invite you to consider seven seismic shifts that characterize the new knowledge worker age. In them, you will find the context of today's workplace and landscape and of your personal challenges. First, the globalization of markets and technologies. New technologies are transforming most local, regional, and national markets into global markets without borders. Second, the emergence of universal connectivity. In the book Blown to Bits, Evans and Worcester state,